Welcome back, everybody, to Rain on Your Parade with J.O. Covan. I am J.O. Covan. I'm sitting in studio with my, I would say, friend. I think we've been doing this long enough. Producer, co-host, everybody's favorite part of the show, Mike. Hello, Mike.
Hi, everybody. Hi, JL. How's it going?
Once again, say hi, JL, first. We go in ranking here. We don't do the high pro. We don't say hi, plebeians, and then hello, king.
Whatever you say, friend.
Thank you. On my way here, I saw a poster. I'd forgotten about this movie, but it's coming out in theaters, I think, for a Oscar qualifying run and then to Netflix. Bradley Cooper's new movie, Bernstein, mm-hmm. about Leonard Bernstein or Bernstein. Or, you know, he was one of the Bears, I believe, also. People don't talk about that, but he was both a cartoon bear. JL, that's Bernstein. Shut up, okay? Shut up.
He had a hell of a career, that Leonard.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you don't see, that's kind of a Bo Jackson sort of existence, like, yeah. In the composer conductor category and in beloved animated bears. Let's see Winnie the Pooh do a fucking orchestra.
Yeah.
Is that what they call it? Do an orchestra? I think that's what they call that's what they say the slutty cellist does. She does an orchestra. Could be a man also. Could be a man also. Right. Or are they? This is an inclusive podcast, but I saw a poster for it and I gotta say, I still don't think the nose is particularly particularly egregious. Like, in other words, if he's using prosthetics, it's not, he's not rocking Toucan Sam level, which, by the way, was the first choice to play Leonard Bernstein. But when I saw the poster on my way here in the subway, I thought, oh yeah, that movie. And then I thought, remember like 3 months ago when that was trending on Twitter because that was the big anti-Semitism issue?
I do, yeah. I think some of it had to do with the fact that I don't think Leonard Bernstein's nose was even close to that big. So I think that the overall thinking was like, how did some producer or some costume?
But they got the horns just right.
It's a tough time for a horns joke with the Jews. I got to be honest.
I meant the horn section.
Oh,
I see what you did.
It's an orchestra movie.
My mind wasn't in that that gutter.
No, of course not. And I mean, in modern times, who could think anybody would even be remotely anti-Semitic?
The educated comedy fan thinks that I have the best air trumpet in the game.
You've told me, yeah.
I was looking for you to confirm that, not to confirm that I've told the story. I was looking for you to confirm the fact that I do, but obviously...
It's good.
Obviously, we're going to have another meeting with HR after this episode. but yeah, it dawned on me, and I'm not one of those people who's like, stop complaining, like that only a massacre is worthy of discussion, but it did draw in great contrast that like 3 months ago, it was like, have you seen Bradley Cooper's nose? Oh my God. What is going on? So my question is very simple. Did Bradley Cooper order Hamas to attack Israel?
He's got friends in high places, that Bradley Cooper.
Well, he's no Garth Brooks.
Why would Garth Brooks do?
Well, he's got friends in low places. Oh. Yeah.
Friends
in low places. I ruin country music to all your faces. Yeah, it's just one of those things that don't like, not you could make a profound point or you could make a flippant point, but it was just like, you know, think of who benefits from what happened. And I'm like, Bradley Cooper is obviously a pretty big power player. Mm-hmm. And we haven't talked about his nose once until this podcast. And that's why people come here, because they're like, JL sees behind the lies and gets to the hard truths. So my question simply for Bradley Cooper, if he's listening, which I've heard he does from time to time.
Right.
Did you order the code red? I'm just saying, I think it's a question that nobody's asking and we should be asking. You know, red pill, right? We're red pilling people right now, I think, you know, and that's what Alpha Bros do.
Yeah.
We told people.
Yeah.
They didn't believe. There were some skeptics. They were like, JL, you keep promising Alpha Bro content. You keep promising the porn stars, but I don't see them. Well, you just got your first dose of Alpha Bro podcasting. And yeah. I bet it feels good. But I look forward to seeing that movie. I played, and by the way, I might be part of the problem because when I was on Billions, I played a Jewish character. Okay, Darren Rusikoff. And I had to blow a shofar so I was doing real Jewish stuff. Like that's the horn, not the one on Bernstein's head, but but I couldn't really do it, so they had to add sound effects. So I'm not even, the point is, anti-Semitism hurts me. As somebody who's played a Jewish person, it hurts me just as much as it hurts the Jewish community. So I stand in total solidarity. But my question is very simple. Bradley Cooper, where were you on October 7th? And can we see your emails? You know, that's it. That's it. And if you have nothing to hide, you know, we'll just enjoy your movie on Netflix with no problem. But I think I'm asking the question that needs to be asked that a lot of people aren't asking. So, yeah, that's it. That's all. That was just my opening thought. That's JL's opening thought. Do we have graphics for that yet?
Not yet. Working on it.
Mike's just happy that my opening thought wasn't 19 minutes long.
Yeah.
Okay.
I am happy about that, actually.
Finally, when I'm shitting on myself, I get robust agreement from Mike.
7 minutes was enough.
It's like I have James Harden producing my podcast, just completely attacking the team from within. I want to talk about a couple things. First of all, my nephew made first team all league in soccer, very competitive New Jersey soccer league. Now we wait for county and state. He was the only junior from his team, I believe, that made first team all conference.
Good for him.
So yeah, he's real good at soccer, and I was very pumped to see that. Not so pumped to see some of the players from the racist team. I'm sorry, it's New Jersey soccer, the most racist team, also making first team, but it was inevitable because some of them, hey, sometimes racists have talent. And I'm not one of those people who will say, you know, Ted Cruz is an idiot. Well, no, he's not. He's a terrible person, but he's actually very smart. Hmm. So, you know, whether it's Ted Cruz or racist high school soccer players in New Jersey, I don't deny them when they do something good. I just get upset when they do. But last night, Mike, are you a fan of the theater?
I love the theater. Yeah,
you do. I love the theater, too. And I felt like I see all sorts of things. I like my classical theater. I like my award winning theater, et cetera. But sometimes if something gets good reviews, I'll see the mass market, the thing that kind of offends. And last night was one of those nights. I saw Back to the Future, the musical, which still sounds odd to say. It still sounds a little offensive to just be like, because there was a movie called Hamlet 2. Did you see Hamlet 2?
I loved it.
Hamlet 2 is one of my favorite comedies
ever. Steve Coogan, right?
Steve Coogan delivers.
And the South Park guys.
Yes.
Yeah,
I think they were like, some of the South Park guys were like in a production state. They didn't write it, I don't think. But Hamlet 2, everybody, if you haven't seen it, is an absolutely incredible comedy. Steve Coogan's performance is like one of my 20 favorite performances ever.
He's really, really funny in that.
He's so good in this. Dana Mars. And in the movie, which came out in theaters in 2008, he plays a drama teacher in, I believe, Tucson, Arizona.
Kind of like Waiting for Guffman sort of.
It's vibes. And no offense to Christopher Guest, better.
Yeah, I think so too.
But it's not an unscripted thing.
Yeah.
It's very scripted. But he is a down and out drama teacher in, I believe, Tucson, Arizona. And his gimmick with his class is every year he adapts a movie into a musical. This is how far we've come in 15 years. That premise alone was like comical.
Yeah.
Now that's what we do.
Yeah.
And Mike and I off mic last week had a very interesting discussion about art in general and where it's headed. And we don't have to get into all that, but there were some
to sum it up, it wasn't positive.
It was not positive. And it's one of those things that we've discussed, how we do video components for the podcast, and it's just a necessary evil now if you want to grow anything or even just get noticed. And there was a time where it was like, oh my God, they're making a musical out of blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there were a lot of talented playwrights and musical theater folks, gays, I'm sorry, who would say, absolutely not. I've written a great original piece. Like, I'm not adapting SpongeBob SquarePants or blah, blah, blah.
Shrek.
I'm not doing that. And then eventually the dollars dictated. And those were the things that would get produced because they felt the producers were confident in a return on their investment.
Well, can I also add, I do think that one of the caveats to this is that a handful of those adaptations early on were critically acclaimed, like specifically The Lion King.
Oh, which
has been running for 20 years, probably something like that. So you had a couple of cases like that where, like, The Lion King, they went on stage, they did something that was a little, it's sort of the similar, same story, but they did something visually.
Of course.
Yes, like different. And that was kind of like a first for Broadway. But now, yeah, it's you know, Shrek the Musical, it's whatever, you know, the producer, same thing, great adaptation, possibly better than the movie, you know. Anyway.
Yeah, well, no, and that's the so you're in this dilemma where it's like, well, this isn't real theater, but it's like at some point, if the work is on these things, then maybe it is good. Like, some of these things are good because you can be a starving artist or you can be a good artist who's getting money,
right?
Who's getting paid. And at least I feel like the more of these things you see popping up, the more you're like, well, this isn't being written by some hack. They're getting good because the money and the work is in some of these projects. So I was getting some shit from people like about Back to the Future, the musical. And I go, well, I've heard it's good. It might stink. It might not. But I'm going to see it because it might be good. And I'm interested. And I've heard good things, at least visually. So I see it last night. And my overall review of it is it was mostly enjoyable. There were a couple of performances that I thought were outstanding. A couple that I didn't like. I thought the music early on for a musical, this is a Kiss of Death, I thought the first three or four songs were not good, which is sort of stunning.
Were they like 80s kind of style? Like, what was the vibe?
No, it was very like, you know.
Yeah.
Like, so you gotta, with, the, so I, me and Laura looked at each other and we're kind of like, uh-oh, like, have we been fooled? Have we been duped? But the effects, the stagecraft, it's going to be Tony nominated for its stage work, and it's not really called effects, but you know, their production design absolutely might win.
Yeah.
I think the guy who plays George McFly should probably get a nomination for featured actor. But what was weird is first the lead actor and the guy playing George McFly were basically doing incredible impressions of Michael J. Fox and Crispin Glover.
Yes.
Which I thought was weird. Because it's like, well, this is a chance to like make the character in your own image. And they're kind of copying them. And especially in the case of Michael J. Fox, that's a pretty bold, it's one of his most, if not his most iconic role. And it's pretty bold, even though he did a good job impersonating him, you could have just done your own thing. But the guy who played overall, we left the show pretty happy. Like, I'd say a thumbs up. It's not like, oh my God, run out and see
enjoyable.
This right away. But thumbs up.
Not overall. A bad night.
Yeah, they dug themselves a hole with some bad opening songs, which you never expect. But overall, thumbs up. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up and why it's such a good topic to kick off the show for Rain on Your Parade is we've already talked about manners on a previous episode, but we didn't really get into theater too much. I think we may have talked about people's wardrobe at theater, maybe during fashion, maybe during manners episode. But there are specific instructions before the play because it's sort of the design is kind of proprietary and kind of part of the appeal and the secret, you know, like, hey, like, whoa, there's a lot of like stage work. Well, they specifically say no photography because they know people might want to take three different people. I saw taking photos with their cell phones, including the woman right in front of me, filming scenes, which I was disgusted by, but you know what? This is the world we live in. And then, in the first 30 minutes of the play, the actor playing Doc Brown, who, if you look him up, is like somebody with a lot of stage credits. I think he's been Tony nominated. I've seen him in many shows, like in guest roles on shows. I didn't know he was a Broadway guy until seeing him here. He holds up something for Marty to see. And a woman about five rows in center orchestra raises her hand and goes, "Can you show it to me? I can't see it." And Laura grabbed my leg because in this like instinctive, what the fuck are we watching right now?
Yeah.
The look this actor, and I apologize, I have the playbill, his name escapes me right now. The look he gave her, he broke character for about 2 seconds. It was like, Homelander on The Boys. Like, if he had the ability to laser her to death, her head would have exploded right there.
Yeah.
He took a beat, and I could tell he considered saying, "Are you fucking kidding me?"
The actor. Casey Likes.
No, that's not him. Doc Brown.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, let's give him his rage flowers.
I think it's Roger Bart.
Yes.
It is, right?
Yes. He was looking at Marty, like looking in a different direction. So he had to pivot.
Who, by the way, Roger Bart, like a serious, acclaimed,
right,
accomplished Broadway actor.
Yes. And I had recognized him from TV things.
Yes. Yeah.
Until I looked at the playback. And so this is somebody who is serious about the work.
100%. Yes.
Even though it's fun. Just like I'm serious about stand-up. Stand-up is not supposed to be serious. But I'm serious about it. That's right. Why I'm mediocre at it.
Yeah.
So this guy is I think when you're in your performance, you are trying to get lost in your performance, in your character.
Yes.
And I bet you for a second, you don't even know why you're being interrupted. And it's probably jarring. You probably feel some anxiety. You might feel a shot of anxiety that then turns to rage. The look he gave her, I was like, I feel seen.
Yeah.
He was, and I was just like, what? You know, I immediately turned into sort of, you know, Sebastian Maniscalco, of course. And I was like, what are we doing? Like, what are we doing? Like, I didn't get the reaction quite from you, but a woman, a grown woman, like in her 50s or 60s,
hey,
raising her hand to interrupt. What the fuck? Matt Rife is not on stage ruining comedy, ma'am. Save it for Radio City Music Hall when a bunch of sad women who don't know good comedy from their fucking assholes are screaming like Tom Jones is in the house.
Yeah.
Save it for that.
Yeah.
This is a play, not a Matt Rife experience.
Yeah. Well, listen, man, we growing up, I used to hear stories because that was one of the one indulgences my mom really liked for us to have when I was in like middle school and high school. She would take us to shows. We'd go into the city. I saw the producers with like the original cast and everything.
Oh, nice.
And I think if you are somewhat local, New York, Connecticut, just tri-state or whatever, you get the etiquette down when you go to the theater. You're a New Yorker.
Shorts,
like,
Crocs, talk.
Right. So this was the thing. When I was a kid, we dressed to go to the theater. Not in a tuxedo, but my mom wanted to make sure that my mom would wear a dress. My dad would wear like slacks.
Absolutely.
I would have to wear slacks or whatever. Like, it was a real serious thing, especially at that time. Like, that was at the time where Broadway tickets were getting to be $100 tickets.
Right.
Which was new in like 2001, 2002, you know? And I think that there's so many people, a show like Back to the Future specifically, part of the reason you put that show on is because you're trying
Absolutely.
To win over the nostalgia ticket from people that are visiting New York.
Yeah, and the masses. Like, you want
right.
a broadly appealing show. I get it. It's not Ibsen.
Right.
Or Shakespeare or some shit.
Exactly, right. Or a black box theater or something like that. You're not going to see like experimental theater. But and unfortunately, I mean, I think that the like society at large is decaying, which is a larger conversation. But you also have, you know, there's not a big theater culture in some of the places that these people are visiting from.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
In fact, they're anti-theater because that's right. where they make your kids gay.
Right. Yes.
I think one of the issues, and now I'm not even complaining about, I went, you know, Laura was in a dress. I was in slacks, shoes, and a button-down shirt.
It's driving me nuts. You have no idea. The microphone is driving me insane.
But it keeps tipping away from me.
We'll fix it during the break.
Okay, good. Good job.
Anyway.
Hey, guys. How are you? I got a big microphone in my mouth. I wouldn't even question the dress of people at it. Like, when you make Back to the Future the musical, you go in sneakers and jeans or short. I'm like, this is a fun time. I get it. This is like half Broadway musical, half Universal Studios theme park
yes.
ride. So I get that.
Exactly.
That wouldn't have been a complaint because we're not seeing high theater. It's not Death of a Salesman or
yeah.
something. but the etiquette of like, but it's still like, what has happened to people? Like, that's the worst thing I've seen yet at a theater. So bad that I question whether the woman was having an episode or was like an older person having a senior moment. And I'm being serious, because if it wasn't, what are you? You're asking a question of somebody in a musical.
Yeah, but all right, listen, here's part of the other thing too.
Roger Bart certainly didn't fucking like it.
Listen, I'm on Roger Bart's side, trust me, believe me. But
don't ask if Roger Bart is on our side. Ask if we are on Roger Bart's side, if I can paraphrase a Lincoln quote.
Yeah, that's right. I think that made sense. I think that we're in a place when these tickets start getting so expensive, people with no class who spend a lot of money on a ticket. Can I ask, how much was your ticket to Back to the Future?
It was a gift. So if I had to guess, I'd say they were like
120,
130 a pop. Yeah,
okay. So,
and if she sent her orchestra like fifth row, those are usually premium seats. So you're probably talking
$300
at least 200.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah. So if someone paid $200 to $300 and they don't necessarily have etiquette or,
because as Countess Luann said on The Real Housewives of New York, money can't buy you class.
That's right. I do wonder if the consumer at large thinks that they spend $200 to $300 on something that they can do and act however they want because they've spent a bunch of money for the evening to have fun, and your fucking etiquette and rules are not going to get in the way, man, of me having fun. I want to see every angle of that stage, Roger Bart. I want to see, like, I think it's a stupid way to, but this is kind of our off-air conversation that we had last week. You know, define what special is now.
Right.
Like, what do you do in your life that feels special enough that you have respect for it?
Right.
And I think that when I was growing up, the theater was certainly one of the last places where it was just like, wow, isn't this special? Isn't this an amazing thing to be a part of? There's Nathan Lane, like, you know, like right in front of me, just doing his thing. And like, that was overwhelming as a 12 or 13 year old. Whenever I saw The Producers, that was like life changing to see that and just be like,
you became a podcast producer because of The Producers.
Well, but like, even pursuing stand up or pursuing show business, like, not that The Producers was a stand up production, but like, that was something that definitely pushed me in a direction where I was like, I think I want to do something like this. This is incredible and amazing.
Right.
And I don't know if everybody feels that way when they see something. Like, I think some people just are like, I feel like I kind of know this IP. Back to the Future, like, cool, that's, I want to do Broadway, and like, this is the best of both worlds, and I'm going to give you $150 and I'm just going to act the way, however I want to act. It goes back to the Bobert thing, kind of, doesn't
it? Well, and I, believe me, when I started groping Laura during the Back to the Future and she smacked my hand away, I said, you'll never be a congresswoman with that attitude. By the way, I don't blame
her. Where's your vape, lady?
I don't blame, you know, Lauren Bobert, I'm fine with what you, not the vaping.
No, I'm not even getting on
sex play in front of kids. Totally fine. If you're a hot congresswoman, I'm okay with it.
I just mean, I think people have that mindset now where it's just like, I don't know if it's like a post pandemic thing and you just do so much in your home, but it's one of the reasons that I think, like, to use the word content, a word that we both hate, like, the reason that a lot of the stuff that gets made now doesn't really feel special is because it's kind of not.
Right.
Like, it's just put on the streamers or put out so you can just, like, watch it and move on.
It's algorithmic kibble.
Right.
The way I feed Cookie and she's excited for her meal, 7,500 straight meals of kibble. Oh shit, kibble?
Yeah, right.
You just got to keep feeding it. No offense, Cookie. I love you. Yeah. But I thought about this in the broader sense of, because I'm a 5 to 6 Broadway plays and shows a year guy.
That's still
good, but
enough.
This year, after losing my job, that's why she got the tickets. I was like, you know, I've been picking up the slack on Broadway shows. You mind getting this one?
Yeah.
But I try to mix it up. I'll see a big critically acclaimed mass market show. Not because I'm like, I really want to see The Wire, the musical, but if it got like a gold star
How
from
insane
the Times.
Would that be?
It's coming. Omar's coming. Omar's coming. He's got a shotgun and he sucks some dick. Omar's coming. Pow! He got them and he robbed their drugs.
Good Lord.
His name is his name and his name is Marlo. His name is his name.
He wants his corners.
Look out, Bodie. You're not one for this world because Marlo is his name. Oh, no, it's the white season. It's the one on the docks. No one cares. What the fox? Oh, man.
It's season two. It doesn't mean much, but you need it for the last scene of the show.
There you go.
Yeah. Love it.
Anyway, yeah, that was The Wire, the musical. Send me your checks, producers, if you want to talk. Let's get this done. But I see a mix. I see a mix of stuff. But of course, if I see like, hey, there's a big play I've never seen or I've missed. You miss some. It's sad when you're like, oh, no, that won't be around for another 20 years now. But I remember seeing Audra McDonald in Ohio State Murders. And it was this critically acclaimed play that was being produced for the first time. She's a 6-time Tony winner, the most ever, like Meryl Streep of stage, of Broadway. Theater was, I saw it like close to its opening. It was like theater was half empty. It closed early. And I was just like, there aren't even enough people artistically curious because I was just like, I don't know what this is about. You tell me it's got good reviews. It's starring this kind of modern legend of theater. Yeah, I'll go see it. If I love it, great. If I don't, well, you know, you don't always win. As Sebastian Maniscalco described, going into an ice cream shop, he goes, "I don't do samples." You get it. You like ice cream? What's that? I'll have that. And then I don't do samples. What's this? But you know, if you're Audra McDonald, I complain all the time about my comedy and why don't my fans like. If you're like a legend and it's like, we couldn't sell a fucking theater, like what's going on? Like this wasn't going to be Hamilton where it lasts for 15 years or 20 years. This is a limited run, but I'm a legend. It's a critically acclaimed play. Where is everybody?
It was empty when you saw it?
Not empty, but it was like, even the orchestra wasn't full.
No shit.
And I saw it pretty early in the run, not like when it was tapering off.
Yeah.
And it's just a weird thing because even as a kid, I just feel like Broadway was a bigger deal. Like in our lifetimes, Broadway was a bigger deal culturally, aesthetically. Like it was, like I said, I just feel like I'd feel weird unless I had an injury going to a Broadway play in sneakers.
Well, dude, I do think the ticket price is a part of it. And I think that
I think it's weird that the ticket price doesn't let people know this is important. Like,
no, but this is what I think happens. I think it's just like movies. Like the whole thing in movies now is about getting as much IP as you can. And that's the value. Like the value is not in the actual movie. It's about having Barbie, you know? And it's just like, this is going to make us $500 million.
Well, thank God they made a good movie. I really liked Barbie.
Yeah.
I'm glad they made a good movie.
I'm not shitting on it.
Right.
I'm just saying it's like,
because they didn't have to. The problem is they probably didn't have to make a good movie.
Yeah, they didn't. I think it was just like, they had Margot Robbie. She looks like Barbie. They had people involved that I think got women excited. That's a different conversation. The point that I'm trying to get to is that now Mattel, a toy company, not a production house, a toy company says, we had a huge hit with Barbie. What else can we make? Can we make Hot Wheels into a movie? Can we make, and they're going to do a Polly Pocket movie. It's the same thing on Broadway, that's why there is a Back to the Future musical.
But I don't mind. I'm sorry to interrupt, but on the Mattel issue, I don't mind when businesses act like businesses, but it's like when art, when there's not enough power among artists to push back and be like, it's still got to be art. Like Mattel, the guy who, I read an article about it. I think he's an Israeli guy who kind of became the head of Mattel. And he said, we're not a toy company. We're an IP company. Yeah. And hey, great business decision.
Yes.
You're like, and toys to me are not sacred. They're sacred in terms of our nostalgia, but whatever you can make from a toy is like flour. You can make a cake. You can make, I don't know what else you make with flour. A lot of stuff.
Bread.
Bread. You can make a lot of stuff, but like toys are almost like an ingredient. They're not like in and of themselves a be all end all, leave it sacred.
But I think the issue, JL, is that we're working backwards now, as opposed to somebody saying, like, yeah, they can take G.I. Joe and they haven't yet, but like they could take G.I. Joe and turn it into art and turn it into like something cool and interesting. But it used to be the reverse where you made Star Wars first. Right. And then you got the toys from Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like you would write the fucking thing first. And now the same thing's happening. Not like all over. There's still your Hamilton. But even Hamilton. I mean, Hamilton is a historical, fictionalized play based off of a Chernow biography.
Oh, very good. Good Chernow drop.
Yeah. You know, I know what's going on.
Hey, Ron.
But like.
Fan of the show.
You know, again, that's not IP, like hard IP.
Yeah.
It's inspired, you know, but that's kind of the name of the game now. You start with Back to the Future and you say how like this will entice what like if we have to justify a $150 ticket.
Right.
People from out of town are more likely to go see this fucking thing than they are to see, you know, the Boys in the Band or something like that.
Yeah.
Which will have like a set like a 2 month run.
And they'll have to stack it with Hollywood actors like. Like there's all the compromises in the world that have to be made. And I, you know, I look at certain professions as much as I bitch and moan about stand-up comedy. And there's plenty to be genuinely like disgusted by about the future of the abomination, the apocalypse that is stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
But man, theater, if I were like a real, you know, a playwright not named fucking David Mamet.
Yeah.
I'd be like, what am I doing? Like I'm making good work and I can't like. I got to like travel to independent theaters, which are, by the way, losing financing.
Yeah.
So it's like you're in. And that's what I've always said. I don't like opera and I'm not a big fan of ballet. But there is a part of me that's just like my Laura and her mom, especially her mom's a big opera person. Sometimes I just want to be like, let me go again, because I bet you that's one of those spaces. And then you'd have people complaining that maybe it's too old and white. But no.
Well, opera, I think that there are. Since it's not such a hot ticket mainstream thing, it's like a kind of like elitist exclusive. I don't even want to use the word elitist, but like an exclusive New York thing because of Lincoln Center or whatever. Right. There are new operas. There are, and they're not like, it's not like, you know, The Grinch, the opera. It's, you know what I mean? It's like, it's people are actually writing new things. There was one that I wanted to see and I forget what it was now, but my girlfriend is formerly a ballet dancer. So she goes to
a belly dancer?
Ballet. I'm
kidding.
Oh, all right. I thought you actually misheard me. But
I don't mishear anything.
But I do think you're right. That is one of the spaces that's sort of untouched by just like, because it doesn't have to be. I don't think it was ever a business commercialized the way that Broadway has been.
And ballet, know? Similarly, like there'll be the occasional thing, but mostly it's like you either like, even if it's, if you have to put up with a little snobbery, but it's like, but there is something nice about a formality and an art frozen in time, because art has an eternal quality to it when it's respected and
there's
admired.
A preservation to it.
Right.
It's a classic sort of thing that has, right. I don't think, I mean, hasn't been revolutionized, at least to the minds of the plebeians like us. I wouldn't know the difference between ballet dancing now and ballet dancing in Russia in 1780 or something.
Right. And it's a weird thing, because of course you could have criticisms of both those worlds, I assume, but at the same time, it's like, but the art is preserved. And I know there were people saying, dude, you went to Back to the Future, the musical. What did you expect? And I go, not a woman to ask questions mid-show.
To the actors.
If I saw a guy wearing Crocs in front of me, I wouldn't even be talking about it right now. I'd be like, hey, it was Back to the Future, the musical. But excuse me.
Yeah.
I can't say. I'm surprised he didn't throw the flux capacitor at her fucking head.
I'm surprised she didn't get thrown out.
You know, and people coming late to shows.
Yeah.
You know, that's enough on this topic. But it's a very frustrating sort of thing. Yeah. So when we come back, another frustrating thing, very small, very minor thing. We're going to talk climate change when we come back.
Tiny,
so
tiny thing.
You know, back to the future. You know, it ties. JL can tie these things together. You know, we're talking about the future. We're talking about the past. We're going to talk climate change after this quick break. And we're back with Rain on Your Parade. That was a fun discussion about theater. Mike, thanks for chiming in. But now I want you to be quiet because this is important.
Okay.
We're talking about climate change in this segment. And the reason I want to talk about climate change, it's sort of important. I think you'd agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's top 10 issue.
It might have been important a decade ago. But now.
Well, we could do something about it.
Right.
Yeah. And the reason I thought of climate is I first want to start with, and I touched on this last week a little bit, but the abortion issue, as of this, when you hear this, everybody, a few weeks ago, there was a lot of votes on election day and many of them centered around anti-abortion versus pro-choice or pro-life versus anti-life, however you want to phrase it, issues. And all the pro-life, anti-choice sides lost. And it dawned on me, and I said this on a couple other podcasts I guessed it on, but it was very clear that, you know, Paul Mooney had the what he referred to as the N-word wake-up call for black people or people of color who thought they were white or thought they were fully accepted. And then all of a sudden there's that one moment that happens that's your wake-up call. I thought that,
anyway.
I thought this election, this round and Trump was a vagina wake-up call for a lot of women.
Yeah.
And those women would largely be, I think, not exclusively, but largely be suburban white women who for so many years have taken for granted what the Democratic Party stands for. In other words, well, yes, I know the Democrats are the pro-choice party and Republicans are pro-life and I'm not like personally down with like the stringent pro-life message, but I'll be fine. Like, I'm not going to lose my right to an abortion. That's pie in the sky, aggressive Republican like fundraising tactic and election scheme, but they're not actually going to do it. I'm safe. So in my safety, I can vote on taxes. Like taxes can go from like seventh most important issue to like two.
Yeah.
And I can, even though my community maybe isn't overrun by immigrants or we're not really dealing with a crisis at all, I get it. Cause honestly, if that was my neighborhood, we had some people move in. I wasn't a big fan of them. But mainly it was about the feeling safe because you didn't think it could happen. So you were willing to gamble with other people who were more marginalized or lived in those states where it actually could hurt them immediately than you. And then the vagina wake-up call happened.
Mm.
And Trump, shockingly, a man who grabbed women by the pussy and bragged about it, got his hands around yours. And you said, no, not me.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you realized, and to be fair, I say this all the time, but like, if you're a real pro-life, if you're pro-life, you know, for real, I can respect your consistency, your ethic, your consistency. You don't have to like it, but the person who today is as hardcore pro-life as they were 5 years ago and is then at least we know where you stand. We know where you stand. You stand on your principles, whatever they may be, and we understand that. It's the people who start going, I'm pro-life. But then once they realize people don't like it, they're like, maybe I'm not as pro-life. Like Nikki Haley's doing the dance of like, I'm personally pro-, like she's already doing the I'm personally pro-life. Well, so is fucking Joe Biden. Like you're trying to have it, like you've ridden the coattails of the hardcore pro-life movement. And now you're like, but I'm trying to pivot to like something that more people will like. Then it's not really a principle. It's not really a guiding principle. You've been lying about that. Your guiding principle is being elected. And too many voters in this country, and in this case, I think it was white suburban women, were willing to gamble other people's rights because they never thought it would be theirs and were willing to put their taxes above your bodily autonomy. Now that it's their bodily autonomy, they're like, actually, I do care. And I think that's very interesting and bodes very poorly for the planet. Because what I'm realizing is it's not the economy stupid, the famous James Carville quote. It's the selfishness stupid. And until everything can be selfish, the climate, once the climate is a selfish issue, we're done. It's like, yeah, once three of your family members drown in a coastal tidal wave or burn up in a fire, that's too late for you to like be like, okay, I changed my mind. No. The mind, there's no time to change the mind. There's no room to change the mind. We need a climate wake-up call, okay, right now, which we're not having.
Well, hold on. What else do we need? What else do people need to see that don't believe? This summer was brutal.
Yeah, but and here's the problem. It happens to a few farmers in the Midwest. It happens to Californians. Maybe that's God burning them up in the fires of perdition for all their gay homosexual ways. You ever think about that podcast, Mike?
I didn't know.
About Hawaii? The sinners of Miami being flooded by the Lord is just punishment for their transgressions and their OnlyFans. If New York gets flooded, guess what? Okay, all them greedy Jewish people, it's just a fact. Drowning in their wealth is divine retribution. As long as I'm safe in Texas, Wyoming, North Dakota, as long as I'm safe there, we all good. That's why. That's the answer to your question.
Okay.
Is it's got to be your house. It's got to be your friend, your sister, your son, your daughter. Your house in North Dakota needs to explode for you to go, I guess we should be climate change, Al Gore. That's the answer. It's not immediate enough. It's immediate on a planetary level. But you think when thousands of Bangladeshis drown, there's going to be a come to Jesus moment for all the fake Jesus followers in the Republican Party? Of course not. Well, you know, that's why America is a blessed place, because we don't have Bangladeshis drowning. Oh, but a million people died in a heat wave in India. By the way, a book that I review in my book reviews on my YouTube, the Ministry of the Future, terrifying climate change science fiction, like not, but really emphasis on the science.
Yeah, yeah.
It kind of has this moment where the book opens with a massive heat wave, like in the future in India. Massive meaning kills millions.
Yeah.
Not kills thousands, millions. And it drives certain Indian people to become like global eco-terrorists, where it's like they're taking down planes. Because it's like, no, I don't think you understand. This has to stop. This way of life has to stop. Not like, hey, we got hybrids now. It's like, no. Like they start bombing planes, not for like ideological, for like climate reasons. They're like, we need to stop air travel. And it's an amazing book because it felt so much more science than fiction. Mm-hmm. But that's what it took. And it's this crazy thing where you say, how much more does it take? Well, on a global scale, we're there. But Americans, you know, the only thing we love more than being individuals is like retreating to that out of fear and going, well, it's not happening. You can't make me. You can't make me. And I think we're in real trouble because I see things whenever I see it in my daily life. I try to like see, well, how can we change people's habits? Our habits have gotten worse, not better. I saw a person in my building last year ordering food. A lot of people do this. I like to go for a walk. You know what I mean?
Pick it up.
Yeah, I like to eat in restaurants. I'm happy when we could get back to eating in restaurants. Takeout or delivery is like almost a bad weather or late night thing for me. I see people getting their breakfast delivered now.
Guilty, unfortunately. You Sorry, know, dude.
But to be
but I'm running a business.
The one thing I will also say is where I'm at in Jersey, it's all car. Like you might have a guy on a bike delivering you. At least there's no like ecological damage really if it's a guy on a bike.
But still, I mean, like, if you look at the micro.
No, I think you're a disgrace. Don't get me wrong. I think you're disgraceful.
Yeah, sure.
But I think that when I see somebody getting their breakfast, like, I'm just sort of like, whatever. It could be an isolated incident. But the one that stuck out to me was when I saw a woman waiting and a guy in a car arrived, presumably a Seamless or DoorDash, handed her a bag from Wendy's. Okay. You wanted Wendy's, I get it. Maybe you don't have a car. It's a mile away. But she kept waiting. And another car pulled up with a bag from McDonald's. And I was like, we're fucking done.
I've done this as well. But yes, you're right. It is grotesque. At least it's grotesque.
You can't settle on. No, well, I don't want to just have one fast food. Can they feed it? Can a third person arrive to feed me my French fries? Because fuck the planet in every possible way. It's, well, then I'm glad you're here because you know what?
Listen, I might be an eco-terrorist piglet, but I'm not a hypocrite.
Well, you're on this show and now I'm branded with your eco-terrorism. But it was one that was an eye-opening moment for me because I was like, oh, I guess we can do that. If we're willing, like now we can have two people driving cars to pick up $13 worth of food from two different locations. And it blew my mind. And then, of course, I see commercials for Gold Belly, which is like the extreme version of this. Now,
ship like Gray's Papaya across the country.
Yeah, it's like, I had really good mashed potatoes in Wyoming.
Yes.
Could you put these on a plane and deliver me Mama's mashed potatoes from Cheyenne, Wyoming, please? Yeah. That should be illegal. I'm sorry. That should be illegal. In this day and age, you know, like
it's hard to argue. I mean, like but this is the thing. This is the thing, JL. To your point, I do think convenience is king, and I think that's
why I wrote a blog several years ago that I will share. Perhaps maybe I'll send it to you to put in the show notes for this episode. It was called "Convenience is Killing Us," and then I saw some guy like a year later wrote one on his like meat. I was like, "Get out of here!"
Yeah, you saw it in the Atlantic.
Get out of here!
Damn, I did that first.
I did it first, like Ray J. I hit it first.
Yeah.
I don't think Ray J was first, by the way.
No.
I was first compared to Kanye. The song should have been, I was before you, Kanye. I was 31st. But it's like when I see Gold Belly, I'm just like, what a great idea. And then I go, wait, that's terrible. Mm-hmm. And that's why like little things I can do. I stopped using Amazon. Like I use Amazon in emergencies for like props, but I don't use Amazon for anything. But I don't like... When I order books from Barnes & Noble, but I do pick up in store. Because I'm a book, there are so many things that are not urgent.
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's convenient. No, no, no. At least important. I think important should replace convenient in the way we think about things. Because there are things you need delivered. You need, like, I get it.
So, JL, this is the thing. I think that I think our generation and the generations before us are very responsible for the convenience killing us.
Yes.
But I do think as annoying as Gen Z and Gen Alpha are.
Who the hell are they?
They're the ones behind Gen Z.
How old are they?
Kids. They're like kids.
Like all of them are kids? Or like if I hooked up with like a Gen Alpha person?
I think if you hooked up with a Gen Alpha, you'd be in big trouble.
There's no 18-year-old Gen Alphas?
I don't think so.
So he lied to me?
But I do think they care about the importance of these things. I do think, and I think that's why a lot of like older generations are just like, fuck these kids.
Right.
Who do they think they are? But they're, I think, picking up the mantle of like, we really do have to worry about this because otherwise this is going to be
a big problem. A little less oppressive than Greta Thunberg, though? She's a little harsh.
Sure, I guess. I hadn't thought about Greta in a while, but like, yeah, I mean.
Was she Gen Z?
I think she's Gen Z.
Okay. Yeah. And I think that's what I would say. My ethos would be we need to replace convenient with important. So I'm not trying to deny you good services that we've developed. I'm trying to say no more Gold Belly, no more like three orders from three different restaurants because like you like the fries there, you like this. Like at least when my brother does that, he picks it up.
Yeah, sure.
Because he likes the fries in one place. But I just think we're in real trouble. And I just want to see. There was one other point. I don't like to show that I'm to claim. Don't know what that says. Can't read my handwriting. That's good comedy. But I think climate has to be the next thing that we have to learn our lesson. Democrats, centrists, people who care about the future. There are Republicans who care about climate also. It is the most important issue. That's not saying it's the only important issue, but this shit is, to put it in terms that maybe some people can understand, this is the White Walkers of issues. There are other issues. Do I want Cersei to get away with her bullshit with the mountain? Of course not. But as we saw, Cersei didn't join in Game of Thrones. She was the one holdout who was like, I'll be selfish. Don't be her. The lesson is don't be the incestuous murdering queen. Be part of the solution. And I think it is the most important issue. And if you got your vagina wake-up call from all the what Trump did, who Trump simply acts, I never give Trump compliments. All he did was exactly what he said he would do. Mm-hmm. That's what Trump did. He was the first Republican to run on the dystopian women-hating future, but he did it. You voted for it because you thought, really just taxes. Really just taxes. Nope. Not just taxes, okay? So you got the vagina wake-up call a little late. It's too late for some of the women already in the year or 2 years who had to, who couldn't have care or had to do some back alley shit. It's too late for them. The climate has to be now. It has to be now. Because the, when the wake-up call comes for every one of us, it's because we are burning and drowning. It's too late once that call comes. So I just think, I hope that more people just realize you got to live a little differently. I think we need to live a lot differently. And the one thing I was, one last point on this, because this is what I wanted to say. I think in general, we don't have a sense of helping the community anymore. You know, John F. Kennedy said, don't ask what you, your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Well, if we said that today, Republicans would get people mad that the president was blaming them. And then liberals would say, I feel triggered that you're putting this on me. You're the government. And nobody would do anything. We'd be, both sides would be offended by that statement for some reason. But I often think, what if somebody said for half your take-home pay, after you pay your rent, your health insurance, whatever your necessities are, we're going to take half of your remaining pay. And I can tell you that no one will be without health insurance and no one will be unhoused. I would take that deal. And it would make my life a little more difficult, but not that much. Because I just even said your facilities are guaranteed. Your necessities are guaranteed. And I question how many people would take that to know that we have done so much, because we complain about homelessness as a as an assault on Democrats, not as a we've got to do something for the homeless. And I would just be curious if we could change society in that way. And maybe I'm starting to sound like a Democrat socialist. I don't care. I'm just curious as an intellectual exercise. If I could promise you two of the greatest problems we're dealing with in this country could be eradicated, but you could, you would have to take one less vacation, see 10 less movies, see whatever that, whatever the math would be on that. How many of us would really do that? And I think the answer is not as many as should, and not as many as we need. So get your climate wake up call. You got your vagina wake up call. I hope to the millions and millions who listen to this that they heed the climate wake up call. Anyway, Mike's favorite section coming up next. It's Comedy Talk. Back in a minute.
And now, from the Slickback Studios newsroom in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, here is Scott Pelley with a Rain on Your Parade special report.
I'm Scott Pelley on assignment from 60 Minutes for this week's Punchdown of the Week. Earlier this week, JL wrote on X, formerly known as Twitter, "Me, one ticket to Taylor Swift's movie, please. What the theater employee sees," and he posted a picture of disgraced trainer Larry Nassar, implying with the joke that even though he's innocently buying a ticket to Taylor Swift's movie, the employee sees him as a potential child molester. The comment in reply to that, and this week's Punchdown of the Week, was, and we're trying to find it, excuse me, let me put on my glasses.
Scott, what happened?
The reply was, "Try buying four tickets." Completely unnecessary. And the person added a laugh emoji to their response, but only gave JL a thumbs up for the initial joke. Absolutely disgraceful. You're the Punchdown of the Week.
Oh, JL, you're back.
Hey, everybody. How are you? Like, I love it when Scott just lets me get that bathroom break in during the show.
He's great, isn't he? Isn't he so nice to do the punch down for
Bubbly
us?
Bubbly is how I describe Scott
Pelley. Yeah. Great guy. Anyway, I mean, what's up with you?
You know, he's like some of these guys, like a Brian Williams. Like, you know, Brian Williams is pissed that he can't be doing comedy here.
Yeah.
Like, Scott Pelley's thrilled that he gets to just flex his comedy chops a little bit.
Yeah.
But I got a special to discuss in this week's Comedy Corner. And I didn't look up the title because I was helping Scott Pelley. You know, when you get somebody like Scott Pelley, you help him with the stuff.
Of course, but even being a producer.
But it's from Dina Hashem. And what's her special title? This is what I need to find out. You'd think it would come up right away. No offense to her, but it's the biggest thing that she... Oh, there we go. Here it is. Dina Hashem's new special on Amazon Prime... which I already said I don't use Amazon. It's my girlfriend's Amazon Prime account. Okay. That's how I keep these hands clean. Uh-huh. But I use it only for streaming. I don't think streaming is, but there's a robust competition in the streaming market, whereas shipping and cloud computing, I can't remove myself from their cloud service. But I don't use their stuff for goods and services. Anyway, I already seem like enough of a hypocrite. Dina Hashem, her stand-up special, Dark Little Whispers on Amazon Prime. No, I watched this. I had seen, I think, comedian Sam Morril was one of her producers on this.
Yeah.
And I think she opens for him in a lot of his shows on the road.
I believe so, yeah.
So now I know who to take out if I need to maybe bump up myself in the feature world. but I watched this out of curiosity. I hear her name enough. And I always, a lot of people throw, I've seen this especially around women, but it's often used for drier comics who really aren't that funny or hilarious. But you go, oh, she's a great writer. I think you even kind of instinctively said it.
Yeah, but I meant it.
But you know what I mean when people are like, oh, great writer. It's like your way of kind of being... whenever somebody talks about my comedy, unless I'm writing scripts or sketches, I want them to go, oh, really funny. Asshole, but really funny. Whereas great writer, even if it's true, it's like, but you do comedy, you want the total package recognized
first. Yeah,
before you start parsing it into what works and what doesn't. So I was a little primed for her to be kind of like a downer with some witty jokes and like, but I was praying. But what I saw, it was a really good special. I was really happy with it from almost start to finish. The key test is I call it when I can predict a joke that's coming, I call it a pick six. That's my invention. Not the pick six in football, but the comedic pick six. When I see a punchline coming and call it, Laura has seen me do this with specials where I've called out six or seven punchlines in a half hour. And not always obvious ones, but I'm like, I know where this person's going. She only got one. She got one pick six in 47 minutes.
That's good.
That is good.
Yeah.
That's a good test. Now, I was disappointed when I got it because it was real obvious.
You know, everybody's got a few, right?
Sure. And the fact is, it was almost like she piled all her pick sixes into one pick six.
I had a few pick sixes in my act. I had a lot of, oh!
And she walks up to me and says, everybody, by the way, loves Gianluigi Covini. So
oh, I know. Yeah,
There'll be no slander for JLC. Hey, so we're watching Dina Hashem direct. But I really enjoyed it because what I'll say about it is she has a low-key demeanor on stage.
Yes.
But it's not what I hate, which is when it veers into, I'm doing a character. And you're going to laugh at the character of like, I'm downer girl. Here's a witty joke. But it's made even funnier because I'm like totally not into it. It felt much more authentic, much more like she's just low key. Not like I'm low key because this works, but like I'm being authentic on stage. Really good jokes, funny pretty much throughout. So it's just a strong recommend. And I'm happy because I do go into, I'm such a comedy cynic that I go in with preconceived notions. I've seen the, she's a really good joke writer. And that triggers in me like, okay, does this mean it's like on paper she's good, but the performance is going to be wanting? Really enjoyed it. So Dina Hashem, what did I say? Dark Little Thoughts. Well, it's new on Amazon Prime. Dina Hashem, her new special. I think it's
Dark Little Thoughts, Dark Little Voices. I can't remember.
Dark Little People.
Yeah, Dina is very authentic. That is how she is off stage. I came up with Dina.
Dark Little Whispers. Apologies. Dark Little Whispers.
Dina blew past me pretty quickly, and but she was always extremely lovely and nice, and definitely she's not, it's not a character. She's like that off stage, and I've always loved her. Thought she was really funny. She used to, remember when roast battles were like a really big deal?
Yeah.
She used to dominate those. She was really good on those, and that's why I always say she's a great writer, because you have to be good at that. When I think of like somebody who's really funny, and I don't think of a great writer, I think of like J.B. Smoove, another person who I love dearly.
Also, but not the greatest talker.
Yeah, right. But he's like the type of dude that just like, he makes you laugh. He just like can't not make you laugh.
No one humps a stool better.
Yeah, seriously. He's I love it. I think he's so funny. But Dina, yeah, I mean, I just think immediately fabulous writer, just because of how well I knew her in the scene and how, like, what I would see her do. She just used right. to destroy people on those roasts.
Well, I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear this. I only did one roast battle in my life. It was part of like a festival.
And it's not you.
I eviscerated the, like,
I'm sure
I Oppenheimered him.
Yeah.
But I never wanted to do it because I was just like, can I get a set?
Yeah.
Now we're going through the phase where for the next year and a half, the only way to get into a comedy club is to basically roast someone you don't know, which means either doing a lot of research, which I did when I destroyed this. I mean, I fucking destroyed this. But or it's we're going to make fun of appearances because I don't actually know this person very well. Yeah. And it was like it felt so redundant.
Yeah.
But
Gianluigi looking like his mom makes him a dinner.
Oh. Look at this guy. This guy. Hey, oh, yeah. But yeah, Dina Hashem, a strong recommendation. I always like being pleasantly surprised. Not that I didn't think it wouldn't be good, but I was like, is this going to be good? And I don't really give a shit. It's like, whatever. But yeah. I was like, I finished it. And I was like, that was good. That was a worthwhile 48 minutes of stand-up comedy. I mean, would I have liked it to have been a full hour? I mean, come on. Why are you cheating on the exam? But the point is, it was good. It was really good. I enjoyed it. I recommend it. I don't think anybody out there any real comedy fan would disagree with me. So if you haven't watched it yet, watch it because you're missing out. So there you go. We end on a positive note. Society's crumbling. The climate is destroying. But Dina Hashem, if the world's burning up, make sure you watch those 48 minutes. All right. So that's it, guys. Thanks for tuning in, whether you're listening or watching. Remember, if you like to support the show, join my Patreon, patreon.com/JLCovan. I am going to be in St. Petersburg, Florida, February 9th and 10th for shows. Ticket link coming soon. Beyond that, you know, I got Making Podcasts Great Again, yada, yada, yada. Have a great week. Review us on a podcast platform or give a thumbs up on the YouTube video or both. And we'll see you next Thursday.